A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court by Mark Twain. Samuel L. Clemens. Chapter 42. War. I found Clarence alone in his quarters, drowned in melancholy, and in place of the electric light, he had reinstituted the ancient rag lamp and sat there in a grisly twilight with all curtains drawn tight. He sprang up and rushed from me eagerly, saying, "Oh, it's worth a billion milrays to look upon a live person again." He knew me as easily as if I hadn't been disguised at all, which frightened me. One may easily believe that. "Quick, now, tell me the meaning of this fearful disaster," I said. "How did it come about?" "Well, if there hadn't been any Queen Guinevere, it wouldn't have come so early. But it would have come anyway. It would have come on your own account by and by luck. It happened to come on the Queen's." "And Sir Lancelot's?"
"Just so." "Give me the details."
"I reckon you will grant that during some years there has been only one pair of eyes in these kingdoms that has not been looking steadily askance at the Queen and Sir Lancelot."
"Yes, King Arthur's."
"And only one heart that was without suspicion."
"Yes, the King's, a heart that isn't capable of thinking evil of a friend."
"Well, the King might have gone on, still happy and unsuspecting to the end of his days, but for one of your modern improvements, the stock board. When you left, 3 miles of the London, Canterbury, and Dover were ready for the rails and also ready and ripe for manipulation in the stock market. It was wildcat, and everybody knew it. The stock was for sale at a giveaway. What does Sir Lancelot do but..."
"Yes, I know. He quietly picked up nearly all of it for a song. Then he bought about twice as much more, deliverable upon call, and he was about to call when I left."
"Very well, he did call. The boys couldn't deliver. Oh, he had them, and he just settled his grip and squeezed them. They were laughing in their sleeves over their smartness in selling stock to him at 15 and 16, and along there that wasn't worth 10. Well, when they had laughed long enough on that side of their mouths, they rested up that side by shifting the laugh to the other side. That was when they compromised with the Invincible at 283. Good land!
He skinned them alive, and they deserved it. Anyway, the whole kingdom rejoiced.
Well, among the flayed were Sir Agravaine and Sir Mordred, nephews to the king. End of the first act. Act second, scene first, an apartment in Carlisle Castle, where the court had gone for a few days hunting. Persons present, the whole tribe of the king's nephews, Mordred and Agravaine, proposed to call the guileless Arthur's attention to Guinevere and Sir Lancelot. Sir Gawain, Sir Gareth, and Sir Gaheris will have nothing to do with it. A dispute ensues with loud talk. In the midst of it, enter the king. Mordred and Agravaine spring their devastating tale upon him. Tableau. A trap is laid for Lancelot by the king's command, and Sir Lancelot walks into it. He made it sufficiently uncomfortable for the ambushed witnesses, to wit, Mordred, Agravaine, and 12 knights of lesser rank, for he killed every one of them but Mordred. But, of course, that couldn't straighten matters between Lancelot and the king, and didn't. Oh, dear. Only one thing could result, I see that. War and the knights of the realm divided into a king's party and a Sir Lancelot's party.
Yes, that was the way of it. The king sent the queen to the stake, proposing to purify her with fire. Lancelot and his knights rescued her, and in doing so slew us certain good old friends of yours and mine, in fact, some of the best we ever had, to wit, Sir Belias le Orgulous, Sir Siguarides, Sir Griflet de Fil, de Dieu, Sir Brandiles, Sir Aglovale.
Oh, you tear out my heartstrings. Wait, I'm not done yet. Sir Tor, Sir Garter, Sir Gillimer. The very best man in my subordinate nine. What a handy right fielder he was. Sir Reynold's 3 brothers, Sir Damas, Sir Priamus, Sir Kay the Stranger. My peerless shortstop! I've seen him catch a daisy cutter in his teeth. Come, I can't stand this. Sir Dryant, Sir Lambigus, Sir Hermindy, Sir Pertilope, Sir Perminimines, and who do you think? Rashgawan, Sir Gaheris, and Sir Gareth both. Oh, incredible, their love for Lancelot was indestructible.
Well, it was an accident. They were simply onlookers. They were unarmed and were merely there to witness the queen's punishment.
Sir Lancelot smote down whoever came in the way of his blind fury, and he killed these without noticing who they were. Here is an instantaneous photograph one of our boys got of the battle. It's for sale on every newsstand. There, the figures nearest the queen are Sir Lancelot with his sword up, and Sir Gareth gasping his last breath. You can catch the agony in the queen's face through the curling smoke. It's a rattling battle picture.
Indeed it is. We must take good care of it. Its historical value is incalculable.
Go on.
Well, the rest of the tale is just war, pure and simple. Lancelot retreated to his town and castle of Joyousgard and gathered there a great following of knights. The king with a great host went there, and there was desperate fighting during several days, and as a result, all the plain around was paved with corpses and cast iron. Then the church patched up a peace between Arthur and Lancelot and the queen and everybody but Sir Gawain. He was bitter about the slaying of his brothers, Gareth and Gaheris, and would not be appeased. He notified Lancelot to get him thence and make swift preparation and look to be soon attacked. So Lancelot sailed to his duchy of Guienne and with his following, and Gawain soon followed with an army, and he beguiled Arthur to go with him. Arthur left the kingdom in Sir Mordred's hands until you should return.
Ah, a king's customary wisdom.
Yes, Sir Mordred set himself at once to work to make his kingship permanent. He was going to marry Guinevere as a first move, but she fled and shut herself up in the Tower of London. Mordred attacked, the Bishop of Canterbury dropped down on him with the interdict. The king returned, Mordred fought him at Dover, at Canterbury, and again at Barham Down. Then there was talk of peace and a composition. Terms, Mordred to have Cornwall and Kent during Arthur's life, and the whole kingdom afterward. Well, upon my word, my dream of a republic to be a dream and so remain. Yes, the two armies lay near Salisbury. Gawain's head is at Dover Castle, he fell in the fight there. Gawain appeared to Arthur in a dream, at least his ghost did, and warned him to refrain from conflict for a month, let the delay cost what it might. But battle was precipitated by an accident. Arthur had given order that if a sword was raised during the consultation over the proposed treaty with Mordred, sound the trumpet and fall on, for he had no confidence in Mordred. Mordred had given a similar order to his people. Well, by and by, an adder bit a knight's heel, and the knight forgot all about the order and made a slash at the adder with his sword. Inside of half a minute, those two prodigious hosts came together with a crash. They butchered away all day. Then the king... However, we have started something fresh since you left. Our paper has.
No.
What is that?
War correspondence.
Why, that's good.
Yes, the paper was booming right along, for the interdict made no impression, got no grip while the war lasted. I had war correspondence with both armies. I will finish that battle by reading you what one of the boys says.
Then the king looked about him, and then was he ware of all his host, and of all his good knights were left no more on live but two knights that were Sir Lucan de Butlere and his brother Sir Bedivere, and they were full sore wounded.
Jesu mercy, said the king. Where are all my noble knights becomen?
Alas, that ever I should see this doleful day, for now, said Arthur, I am come to mine end. But would go to God that I wist where were that traitor Sir Mordred that hath caused all this mischief. Then was King Arthur where Sir Mordred leaned upon his sword among a great heap of dead men. Now give me my spear, said Arthur, unto Sir Lucan, for yonder I have espied the traitor that all this woe hath wrought.
Sir, let him be, said Sir Lucan, for he is unhappy, and if ye pass this unhappy day, ye shall be right well revenged upon him.
Good Lord, remember ye of your night's dream, and what the spirit of Sir Gawain told you this night. Yet God of his great goodness hath preserved you hitherto. Therefore, for God's sake, my lord, leave off by this, for blessed be God, ye have won the field. For here we be three on live, and with Sir Mordred is none on live. And if ye leave off now, this wicked day of destiny is past. Tide me, death, betide me, life, saith the king. Now I see him yonder alone, he shall never escape mine hands, for at a better avail shall I never have him.
God speed you well, said Sir Bedivere. Then the king gat his spear in both his hands and ran toward Sir Mordred, crying, Traitor, now is thy death day come.
And when Sir Mordred heard Sir Arthur, he ran until him with his sword drawn in his hand, and then King Arthur smote Sir Mordred under the shield with a foin of his spear throughout the body more than a fathom, and when Sir Mordred felt that he had his death wound, he thrust himself with the might that he had up to the butt of King Arthur's spear, and right so he smote his father Arthur with his sword holding in both his hands on the side of the head, that the sword pierced the helmet and the brain pan, and therewithal Sir Mordred fell stark dead to the earth. And the noble Arthur fell in a swoon to the earth, and there he swooned oft times.
That is a good piece of war correspondence, Clarence. You are a first-rate newspaper man.
Well, is the king all right? Did he get well?
Poor soul, no, he is dead.
I was utterly stunned. It had not seemed to me that any wound could be mortal to him.
And the queen, Clarence?
She is a nun in Almesbury.
What changes, and in such a short while? It is inconceivable.
What next, I wonder?
I can tell you what next.
Well, stake our lives and stand by them.
What do you mean by that?
The church is master now. The interdict included you with Mordred. It is not to be removed while you remain alive. The clans are gathering. The church has gathered all the knights that are left alive, and as soon as you are discovered, we shall have business on our hands.
Stuff! With our deadly scientific war material, with our hosts of trained...
Save your breath. We haven't 60 faithful left.
What are you saying? Our schools, our colleges, our vast workshops, our...
When those knights come, those establishments will empty themselves and go over to the enemy.
Did you think you had educated the superstition out of those people?
I certainly did think it.
Well, then you may unthink it.
They stood every strain easily until the interdict. Since then, they merely put on a bold outside. At heart, they are quaking. Make up your mind to it. When the armies come, the mask will fall.
It's hard news. We are lost.
They will turn our own science against us.
No, they won't.
Why?
Because I and a handful of the faithful have blocked that game.
I'll tell you what I've done and what moved me to it.
Smart as you are, the church was smarter. It was the church that sent you cruising through her servants, the doctors.
Clarence,
it is the truth.
I know it.
Every officer of your ship was the church's picked servant, and so was every man of the crew.
Oh, come. It is just as I tell you.
I did not find out these things at once, but I found them out finally.
Did you send me verbal information by the commander of the ship to the effect that upon his return to you with supplies, you were going to leave Cadiz?
Cadiz? I haven't been at Cadiz at all.
Going to leave Cadiz and cruise in distant seas indefinitely for the health of your family? Did you send me that word?
Of course not. I would have written, wouldn't I?
Naturally. I was troubled and suspicious. When the commander sailed again, I managed to ship a spy with him. I have never heard of vessel or spy since. I gave myself 2 weeks to hear from you in. Then I resolved to send a ship to Cadiz. There was a reason why I didn't.
What was that?
Our navy had suddenly and mysteriously disappeared.
Also, as suddenly and as mysteriously, the railway and telegraph and telephone service ceased. The men all deserted. Poles were cut down. The church laid a ban upon the electric light.
I had to be up and doing and straight off. Your life was safe. Nobody in these kingdoms but Merlin would venture to touch such a magician as you without 10,000 men at his back. I had nothing to think of but how to put preparations in the best trim against your coming. I felt safe myself. Nobody would be anxious to touch a pet of yours, so this is what I did. From our various works, I selected all the men, boys, I mean, whose faithfulness under whatsoever pressure I could swear to, and I called them together secretly and gave them their instructions. There are 52 of them, none younger than 14 and none above 17 years old.
Why did you select boys?
Because all the others were born in an atmosphere of superstition and reared in it. It is in their blood and bones. We imagined we had educated it out of them. They thought so, too. The interdict woke them up like a thunderclap. It revealed them to themselves, and it revealed them to me, too. With boys, it was different. Such as have been under our training from 7 to 10 years have had no acquaintance with the church's terrors, and it was among these that I found my 52. As a next move, I paid a private visit to that old cave of Merlin's. Not the small one, the big one. Yes, the one where we secretly established our first great electric plant when I was projecting a miracle.
Just so. And as that miracle hadn't become necessary then, I thought it might be a good idea to utilize the plant now. I've provisioned the cave for a siege.
A good idea. A first-rate idea.
I think so. I placed 4 of my boys there as a guard, inside and out of sight.
Nobody was to be hurt while outside, but any attempt to enter, well, we said just let anybody try it. Then I went out into the hills and uncovered and cut the secret wires which connected your bedroom with the wires and that go to the dynamite deposits under all our vast factories, mills, workshops, magazines, etc., and about midnight I and my boys turned out and connected that wire with the cave, and nobody but you and I suspects where the other end of it goes to. We laid it underground, of course, and it was all finished in a couple of hours or so. We shan't have to leave our fortress now when we want to blow up our civilization."
It was the right move and the natural one, military necessity and the changed condition of things.
Well, what changes have come? We expected to be besieged in the palace sometime or other, but... Well, however, go on. Next, we built a wire fence.
Wire fence?
Yes, you dropped the hint of it yourself 2 or 3 years ago. Oh, I remember the time the church tried her strength against us the first time and presently thought it wise to wait for a hopefuler season. Well, how have you arranged the fence?
I start 12 immensely strong wires, naked, not insulated, from a big dynamo in the cave, dynamo with no brushes except a positive and a negative one.
Yes, that's right. The wires go out from the cave and fence in a circle of level ground 100 yards in diameter. They make 12 independent fences, 10 feet apart, that is to say, 12 circles within circles, and their ends come into the cave again.
Right, go on.
The fences are fastened to heavy oaken posts only 3 feet apart, and these posts are sunk 5 feet in the ground.
That is good and strong.
Yes, the wires have no ground connection outside of the cave. They go out from the positive brush of the dynamo. There is a ground connection through the negative brush. The other ends of the wire remain to the cave, and each is grounded independently.
No, no, that won't do.
Why? It is too expensive. Uses up force for nothing. You don't want any ground connection except the one through the negative brush. The other end of every wire must be brought back into the cave and fastened independently and without any ground connection. Now, then, observe the economy of it. A cavalry charge hurls itself against the fence. You are using no power, you are spending no money, for there is only one ground connection till those horses come against the wire. The moment they touch it, they form a connection with a negative brush through the ground and drop dead. Don't you see? You are using no energy until it is needed. Your lightning is still there and ready like the load in a gun, but it isn't costing you a cent till you touch it off. Oh, yes, the single ground connection.
Of course! I don't know how I overlooked that. It's not only cheaper, but it's more effectual than the other way, for if wires break or get tangled, no harm is done.
No, especially if we have a telltale in the cave and disconnect the broken wire.
Well, go on. The Gatlings?
Yes, that's arranged. In the center of the inner circle, on a spacious platform 6 feet high, I've grouped a battery of 13 Gatling guns and provided plenty of ammunition.
That's it. They command every approach, and when the church's knights arrive, there's going to be music.
The brow of the precipice over the cave, I've got a wire fence there and a Gatling. They won't drop any rocks down on us.
Well, and the glass cylinder dynamite torpedoes?
That's attended to. It's the prettiest garden that was ever planted. It's a belt 40 feet wide and goes around the outer fence. Distance between it and the fence 100 yards. Kind of neutral ground that space is. There isn't a single square yard of that whole belt but is equipped with a torpedo. We laid them on the surface of the ground and sprinkled a layer of sand over them. It's an innocent-looking garden, but you let a man start in to hoe it once, and you'll see.
You tested the torpedoes?
Well, I was going to, but...
But what?
Why, it's an immense oversight not to apply a...
Test?
Yes, I know. But they're all right. I laid a few in the public road beyond our lines, and they've been tested.
Oh, that alters the case. Who did it?
A church committee.
How kind...
Yes, they came to command us to make submission. You see, they didn't really come to test the torpedoes. That was merely an incident.
Did the committee make a report?
Yes, they made one. You could have heard it a mile.
Unanimous?
That was the nature of it. After that, I put up some signs for the protection of future committees, and we have had no intruders since.
Clarence, you've done a world of work and done it perfectly.
We had plenty of time for it. There wasn't any occasion for hurry.
We sat silent a while, thinking. Then my mind was made up, and I said, "Yes, everything is ready, everything is shipshape, no detail is wanting.
I know what to do now."
"So do I. Sit down and wait."
"No, sir. Rise up and strike."
"Do you mean it?"
"Yes, indeed. The defensive isn't in my line, and the offensive is. That is, when I hold a fair hand, 2/3 as good a hand as the enemy. Oh, yes, we'll rise up and strike. That's our game."
100 to 1, you are right. When does the performance begin?
Now. We'll proclaim the Republic.
Well, that will precipitate things, sure enough.
It will make them buzz, I tell you. England will be a hornet's nest before noon tomorrow if the church's hand hasn't lost its cunning, and we know it hasn't. Now, you write, and I'll dictate thus.
Proclamation. Be it known unto all. Whereas the king, having died and left no heir, it becomes my duty to continue the executive authority vested in me until a government shall have been created and set in motion. The monarchy has lapsed. It no longer exists. By consequence,
all political power has reverted to its original source, the people of the nation. With the monarchy, its several adjuncts died also. Wherefore there is no longer a nobility, no longer a privileged class, no longer an established church. All men are become exactly equal. They are upon one common level, and religion is free. A republic is hereby proclaimed, as being the natural estate of a nation when other authority has ceased. It is the duty of the British people to meet together immediately, and by their votes, elect representatives and deliver into their hands the government. I signed it The Boss, and dated it from Merlin's Cave. Clarence said, "Why, that tells where we are and invites them to call right away." "That's the idea. We strike by the proclamation. Then it's their innings. Now, have the thing set up and printed and posted right off. That is, give the order. Then, if you've got a couple of bicycles handy at the foot of the hill, ho for Merlin's Cave. I shall be ready in 10 minutes. What a cyclone there's going to be tomorrow when this piece of paper gets to work. It's a pleasant old palace, this is. I wonder if we shall ever again... But never mind about that." End of chapter. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.